From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Lovers, he wrote, find secret places inside this violent world where they make transactions with beauty. There's the voice of Jalaluddin Rumi, poet and mystic born 800 years ago this week in the fold of Islam. In today's tough world, Rumi may be the planet's best-known voice of the tender, tolerant, sensual side of Islamic spirituality. In a time of angry cultural standoff, he's wildly popular in America. This hour, On Point, the great Persian Sufi poet of mystical Islam, we're celebrating this week's 800th birthday of Rumi. You can join the conversation. Are you a Rumi lover? Or meeting him here for the first time? And what's your favorite line, favorite image from the great Rumi? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Joining me today in the studio is James Morris, professor of theology at Boston College. He's been teaching and translating the works of Rumi for the past 30 years. James Morris, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
And joining us from St. Louis is Fatemeh Keshavarz, chair of the Department of Asian and Near Eastern Languages and Literatures at Washington University in St. Louis. She is the author of Reading Mystical Lyric, The Case of Jalaluddin Rumi, and most recently of Jasmines and Stars, Reading More Than Lolita in Tehran. Fatemeh Keshavarz, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
What does Rumi stand for to you, if I may ask, Professor Keshavarz?
Oh, a lot of things, but I think more than anything else, dynamism and playfulness. On one level, he is deeply rooted in the tradition, so on that level, he means everything traditional and everything that I'm very familiar with. But at the same time, there is the other side of the coin where he is totally new and playful with everything, and he can turn things around and show you completely different sides of things. So he's a constant surprise.
In a time when we're sort of led to, by circumstance, and I don't know what all, led to see Islam as very austere, he's out there with a great romantic sensibility. Here's just one short poem. Last night you left me and slept your own deep sleep. Tonight you turn and turn. I say you and I will be together till the universe dissolves. You mumble back things you thought of when you were drunk. Wow, we're into a wonderful sensual realm right there. James Morris, who was this man?
Well, first I'll say who he was and then a little bit about his influence. But the important thing is he started out as a religious scholar. His father was a great mystic and mystic teacher, and so he kind of was a religious scholar in those days, meant a court official, a friend of the rulers, and so forth.
Born
so
in what we now call Afghanistan.
Right, but educated in Damascus and raised and really spent most of his life right in Konya in the middle of Turkey. So a very important and you might say a big public figure. And yet, at a key point in his life, he met this wandering dervish, Shamsa Tabriz. And I think that who completely changed his life, and it's really out of his encounter with Shams that he wrote the poetry of all the levels, the quatrains and the lyrics and the great Masnavi, that we identify with him. So this conversion from the austere religious scholar to the great mystic really comes out of this personal encounter. And that's why everybody, I think, can identify with Rumi, because we have that potential in ourselves to be awakened at any time. And whether it's through our encounter with other people or through nature or through love, that possibility of transformation is what he awakens in all of his readers.
Fatemeh, how do you describe the fold, the region, the strain of Islamic culture that Rumi came out of? I mean, did he begin so austere? I've read some of his father's writing, and it's also very playful, quite sensual, at least in terms of in all kinds of ways, interacting with the earth and the things of the earth.
Yes.
How would you describe the strain of culture that Rumi emerged from?
Yeah, well, I think the culture had many sides to it, and it, certainly the austere side or the rough edges are there, and have been there and will be there in all traditions. The unfortunate thing is that now we find the rough edges more newsworthy, and so the other sides kind of get neglected. But I would say that he did have all those sides of playfulness, of love, of ecstasy, of loving poetry in him, and occasionally indulged. I mean, we know that, for example, later on in his sermons, he quotes a lot of poets. So he must have read them before. Or Shams at some point tells him off for reading, that's his master, for reading too much Al-Mutanabbi, who's a great Arab poet. So he must have been reading Al-Mutanabbi. But as Jim pointed out, there is a point in his life where it's around 1244, when he is probably around the age of 40 or so, where this meeting takes place. And in a sense, he realizes that everything that he knew so far in theory, and now he needs to put into practice. And the practice is very much represented by his act of whirling, which is being really a part of the world, not stay on the margins, to come in and play with the world. If the world is animated by the force of love, you can't stay out of that. So I would say that Shams is more of a catalyst, that all the potential is there, but he kind of activates that.
Shams, the great teacher of Rumi, and then soon Rumi is writing, "This I feel now in my body is like an arrow suddenly released to its moment." Jim Morris, two things that come up with always with Rumi. I mean, we'll hear a bunch of his poetry, and we'll hear from Coleman Barks, who's been so important in popularizing Rumi in the United States. But two things. One, Rumi as Sufi and Sufism. I like Sufism. I'd like to look at that. And also the dervishes. I mean, you've already described Shams, his mentor, as a dervish. But then after Rumi's death, I read his followers founded the Mevlevi order, known as the Whirling Dervishes. Mm-hmm. Those two things. First, Sufism. What is it? How does it relate to Rumi?
Well, first of all, I think the important thing is that rather than use the word Sufism, I would just say Quranic teaching, the teaching of Islam. I mean, until the 20th century, the two were virtually identical in every part of the Muslim world. So
every Muslim was a Sufi? Every Sufi?
Pretty much. And
mainstream standard?
And in particular, it's largely through the influence of Rumi and other poets who created these Islamic humanities that Islam moved into the Indo-European cultural world. 80% of the world's Muslims today live in areas where Islam came after the Mongols, after Rumi, and it's largely through the influence of poets and musicians like Rumi. So in those areas, which is almost everywhere but the Arab world, Rumi is the central Muslim teacher, not just a Sufi teacher, and I think that can't be over-exaggerated.
Rumi, with all the centrality as the face of Islam that most encountered, I mean, today we think of Islam, we often think of Arab culture, in particularly kind of Saudi and these days the Wahhabi school.
That's a total illusion, and I won't get into the historical
presently
reasons.
Or historically?
Historically, in other words, that's only since the discovery of oil and conquering of the peninsula in 1924. Let's not even go into the history
of
that.
Well, it lives with us today, but I mean, it's certainly oil and money breeds prominence and pushes things to the fore. Fatemeh, do you see then in Rumi a more somehow mainstream face of Islam than the world is accustomed to perceiving, seeing today?
Absolutely, yeah. And I would even say that he is the tip of the iceberg. Mm-hmm. There are many, many others. There are, you know, people like
Hafez,
Aziz Nesafi, and others that, you know, we won't have the time to talk about. Mm-hmm. But the culture and the language of the people is totally imbued with what these people said and thought. There's no comparison between their influence and, for example, the influence of the Wahhabi Islam that you referred to.
Wow. And in that single observation, so much falls away from our perception here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Jim Morris, you note that you're teaching and at the college. You've got kids sort of handing out books of Rumi poetry like Johnny Appleseed lately. It's that popular. Why?
Well, partly their adolescence, so the love poetry really speaks to what's going on in
sure.
their lives at that time. But I hope more than that, it's important to say that Rumi and all the other poets that Fatemeh alludes to spread, like Johnny Appleseed, who was a Swedenborgian missionary, we forget. so they were the vehicles through which Islam spread to the vast majority of what now we think of as the Muslim world. So they were the equivalent in our culture. I think part of the reason Americans love this poetry so much is we have equivalents. For the quatrains of Rumi, we have Emily Dickinson. For the lyrics, we have Walt Whitman. for the, I have to go a little for the Masnavi. We have, you know, Rilke, T.S. Eliot, mm-hmm. and others. So that strand of using poetry as a central vehicle for spiritual teaching is fundamental in the West, in the English poetic tradition in particular. So Milton, Bunyan. So this isn't something totally new. It's just a new, maybe it comes from an unfamiliar source, but it's very much part of our spiritual and poetic traditions.
Fatima, do you have a passage, just a stanza, a very short one you can read for us? We've got a minute before the break.
Sure.
A couple of lines. What do you love?
Well, plenty, but this is what he says about you and the world. He says, "The world is a mountain. Whatever you say, good or bad, it will echo it back to you. Don't say I sang nicely and mountain echoed an ugly voice."
Wow. I love that.
Yeah. So I think this practicality, this recognizing the human shortcomings and strengths is very much what we respond to these days.
The world is a mountain. Don't criticize what you say coming back to you. In the echo there, Rumi says, your voice is what you hear in return. We're going to really dip into this wonderful realm of Rumi's poetry, so rich, maybe a little more varied than many Americans realize. We'll look at that range as well. Fatima Keshavarz joins us. She's chair of the Department of Asian and Near Eastern Languages and Literatures at Washington University in St. Louis, and we're delighted to have her with us. James Morris, professor of theology at Boston College, is with us as well. You can join us, 800-423-8255. What do you make of Rumi? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great Persian Sufi poet of mystical Islam, Jalaluddin Rumi. We're celebrating the 800th anniversary this week of his birthday, September 30th, 1207. You can join the conversation. Are you a Rumi lover or meeting him here for the first time? And how has a 13th century Muslim mystic reportedly become the single most read poet of 21st century America? What's the magic of Rumi? Where does Rumi take you? And for Muslim poetry readers in particular, is this your man, your muse, or is Rumi so 8 centuries ago? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We've been joined by Fatima Keshavarz. I'm sorry, Fatima, to hang up on that. I know Jim tells me it means farmer in Farsi, so I'll picture that, is with us from Washington University in St. Louis, author of Jasmine and Stars and Reading Mystical Lyric, The Case of Jalaluddin Rumi. James Morris is with us, professor of theology at Boston College, been teaching and translating the works of Rumi for the past 30 years. In a couple of minutes, we'll be joined by Coleman Barks, a great recent popularizer of Rumi in this country. But let's take a couple of calls first. First from Rod in Williston, Vermont. Rod, you're on the air.
Good morning, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. So I just want to make a quick comment. First, I thank both of your guests, the professor from Washington University and from Boston College. It is indeed true that...
Oh, Rod, you're breaking up, and I'm really sorry for it. Perhaps you can get back in range. Let's take another call from Atlanta, Georgia. Marty, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for celebrating Rumi's birthday.
It's such a pleasure.
I'm a yoga instructor or teacher, and I use Rumi sometimes at the beginning of classes or at the end of class. And if people or listeners are not familiar with yoga, it's a practice not of, you know, physical poses, but also of a deep study is really the best way to describe it. And for me and for many, many others, Rumi inspires us to continue that practice. And can I read one of my favorite poems?
We would be delighted.
Okay. And I actually read this to my aunt. My husband and I, our aunt is in hospice. And I was reading Rumi to her the other night, and I read this poem. The cup wants to be lifted and used, not broken. The cup knows there's a state for you beyond this, one that comes with more vast awareness. Sometimes you pour cup to cup, nothing happens. pour instead into your deep ocean self without calculation.
And the yoga master has to be happy to run with Rumi on this, Marty.
Oh, you know, I'm just very blessed and thankful for my aunt's life. And she's a Holocaust survivor, and I whispered, you know, just read this into her. And for me, that's the heart of Rumi, in that he was so amazing and so inspiring, and that he's lasted how many centuries now and will continue to last.
And what a great picture of a 13th century Sufi Muslim poet bringing comfort to 21st century Holocaust survivor in hospice, read to her by her yoga instructor. Is it niece there? Marty, thank you very much. Let's get one more from Richmond, Indiana. Jawad, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning, Tom. Thank you for doing this wonderful program.
It's a pleasure.
I just want to make two comments. I am from Kabul City, and I'm here, a college student in the United States.
Did you say Kabul as in Afghanistan, Jawad?
That's right.
Uh-huh, good.
And so I used to live there in Kabul City until 2002, and I was a religious person up until 2000, and since then I have become less and less religious, and now I'm not religious at all.
Okay.
So what I wanted to, I think the point I want to make is, like, what Rumi means to me as a young person, as a young thinker who's not necessarily religious, but he has a cultural Muslim background.
Yes, of course.
I mean, Rumi is a person who is, who can understand humanity beyond ethics, and who can tell us that, in fact, you do not love God because he is almighty or because he is powerful and he can do all these things to you, but you love God or you like God because he is such a great source of beauty, joy, and happiness. And if you could say a romantic view of the relationship between God and man, or man and universe, I think could be used to revitalize the cultural renaissance in the Muslim world.
Jawad, let me ask you. You say you're a young Muslim who has kind of turned away a bit from the religion, but it sounds to me as though somehow Rumi brings you back, or brings you to something certainly spiritual.
That's true. I mean, when I was born, you know, my family were religious, so, you know, religion was part of the family traditions. But as I went toward, you know, being an adult and, you know, sort of getting closer to the table of the grown-ups, I started to question, what my parents say should be what I have to believe. So by questioning, I started to think of ways and means to find the belief for myself. And I think that's exactly what Rumi does, because of his trouble, you know, his journey from being a religious person into nothingness, and from nothingness back to somethingness. So I'm sort of feeling the same path.
Jawad, we hear it. We hear your seeking, and we can only relate to how Rumi factors into it. That's wonderful. And thanks for your story from Kabul right there to Richmond, Indiana. Fatima, what about Rumi's own sort of religious evolution? Jawad imagines him taking one like his own, a bit away from religion. Do you see that gap ever opening up here, or did he live in a time where that wasn't conceivable? Did he articulate his position?
No, I think it was conceivable. There have been great Muslim thinkers who have doubted everything, including the existence of God. So it certainly was possible within the tradition. I wouldn't say it wasn't possible. But I don't know if he was less religious. I think he just... He was able to, as he got, interestingly enough, more deeply rooted in the tradition and absorbed the tradition. He was able to do away with what he considered not to be essential parts or important parts of the tradition. So there is this great Anne-Marie Schimmel, the German professor who worked on Rumi, and she talked about the Quranization of Rumi's heart. I think that's a great metaphor, and that means that your heart is so immersed in the spirit of the Quran that you're able to interpret it and understand what's the core of it and what it wants you to know, rather than sticking literally to every word everywhere. And so I would say that Rumi isn't any less religious at the later point in his life. He's just more able to benefit from it and to use it as a tool.
Now, this is
and
so interesting how a 13th century poet's story brings a Muslim's relationship with religion into a kind of a dynamic that we know very well from contemporary Christians, and maybe shows us some great commonalities here.
I would tell you that the great translator of Rumi, A.J. Arbery, he says that he returned back to Christianity through Rumi, that he had given up his faith, and once he read Rumi, he was convinced that he needed to get back to his own faith. So this is the quality of, you know, the kind of understanding of what your faith can do for you rather than just being totally imprisoned in one shape of it.
So there's God here and spirituality, but also certainly the earth and sensuality and love. Let's get quick call from Stanley in Montpelier, Vermont. Hi, Stanley. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. Yep. I'm just calling with a favorite line that I remember from Rumi poetry, and the line is, "When love walks through the door, reason flies out the window."
and who doesn't know it? And we go right with it on the magic carpet.
And I just say that Rumi is a great place for love forms.
No kidding.
Yep.
Stanley, it's a great line. And thank you for sharing it with us. You know, this notion that a 13th century Muslim poet should be so popular in this century in this country is quite amazing. I'm reading here the Rumi bestseller, The Essential Rumi, published by HarperCollins, 1995, more than 250,000 copies in print, easily the most successful poetry book published in the West in the past decade. That is a big number for any kind of poetry. And the guy behind it is with us right now from Athens, Georgia. Coleman Barks is here. He's sort of the hot translator who popularized the poetry of Rumi in the United States and the English-speaking world generally, author of Rumi, Bridge to the Soul, just out for the 800th birthday, author of The Essential Rumi and Rumi, The Book of Love. Coleman Barks in Athens, Georgia, thank you very much for joining us.
Tom, glad to be with you.
Can you read something to us of your own presentation of Rumi?
Here's a little quatrain. I am so small, I can barely be seen. How can this great love be inside me?
It's beautiful.
Look at your eyes. Look at your eyes. They're small, but they see enormous things. It's a little conversation in which he asks, how can this great love be inside me? And the answer comes with the metaphor. Look at your eyes. They're small, but they see enormous things. In the same way that the eyes can contain the sky, so the self, human self, can contain this great love that he felt inside him when he met Shams.
Coleman Barks, you have both kind of whipped up and ridden this enormous wave of Rumi popularity. You've been right in the middle of it. I mean, we can hear in the poetry how attractive it is, but articulate for us, put it in words, what is it about Rumi that makes him, I mean, he was much loved there, but why so well loved here and now in this culture, this country, in this century?
I think it has to do with what can come through words. He says, listen to presences inside poems. Let them take you where they will. Follow those private hints and never leave the premises. And I think we're feeling the presence in the words that are even coming through translations of this great human being and of his friend, Shams of Tabriz, and their friendship. So I think we've been lonesome for a true human being, and I think we're feeling that coming through the poetry.
Lonesome for...
And I think we've wanted to feel what it's like to be truly alive and wildly ecstatic and at the same time gentle and disciplined. And we feel that in this poetry.
Good heavens, I'm ready for that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let us take a call from Chris in Nashville, Tennessee. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'd just like to say I'm a big fan of Coleman Barks' translations of Rumi. I think he has brought a great spirit of creativity in keeping with the original writings in a way that we can really understand what he was getting at in English. And it's really inspired me as a songwriter here in Nashville, some of those translations. And I guess I also have a question, which
yes.
is to say that I wonder if one of the reasons that Rumi is the best-selling poet in the United States really is because he speaks across religious traditions, something that it seems like we are having a hard time doing in other forums here.
It is the question, in a way, I guess. Coleman Barks, do you feel Americans yearning to find a sort of warm and loving place to connect with Islam that they might not find in the headlines?
I think that's true, yeah. He has been the one in the history of religions who has dissolved the boundaries so that wherever you are, he deepens you in your sense of the sacred. And so I think that is needed now, and I think he can bring it. He says it's all religions, all this singing, he says, is one song. So he hears the praise impulse inside of all religions, and the great grieving of separation too inside all faiths.
Mm. Fatima Keshavarz, what about the Rumi that contemporary Americans so love? Do you see it as the whole Rumi, the full Rumi, or are we picking up on, I don't know, the most attractive appealing to modernity, to the modern eye angle of this poet?
Well, I think all shades of love for him exist. And there is certainly the Americanized version, which I'm not saying in the sense of, I don't think that it takes anything away from it. I think Coleman has done a great job of turning Rumi's poetry into American poetry, where people could relate to. That has, in a sense, sometimes taken away some of the religious references. For example, there's a great line that in which Rumi talks about, if anyone asks you about the Huris, show your face, say like this. And in Coleman's translation, the word Huri is not there, and he kind of translates that into all our sexual wanting. Well, that is one important aspect of a Huri, which is a heavenly figure, but there are many other aspects to it. But the American reader would relate to this much more easily than to the word Huri. So there's no question that I think there is this aspect of Rumi that a lot of people relate to. But there is a whole multiplicity of ways in which through both Coleman Barks translations and other translations that Rumi's works come across. And I think we're getting more and more the possibility of knowing Rumi in his wholeness.
Well, it's a great conversation. And let us keep right on with it, if we may. Coleman Barks, please stick with us. Fatima Keshavarz in St. Louis and James Morris with me in the studio. We're talking about the great Persian Sufi poet of mystical Islam, Rumi. You can join the conversation. What's the magic of Rumi? Where does Rumi take you? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Hey!
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great Persian Sufi poet of mystical Islam, Jalaluddin Rumi. We're celebrating the 800th anniversary this week of his birthday. It was September 30, 1207, in what we now call Afghanistan, educated in Damascus, spent most of his life in Kona, Konya, Turkey, in sort of southwest central Turkey. And his poetry comes right down through the ages and is perhaps the most popular poetry in the United States today. Think of it, a 13th century Muslim at this time in this century, maybe number one. With us, Coleman Barks joins us from Athens, Georgia. He is the popular translator today of Rumi in the U.S., author of The Essential Rumi, Rumi the Book of Love, Rumi Bridge to the Soul, just out for the 800th birthday. From St. Louis, we're joined by Fatima Kashavarz. She is at Washington University in St. Louis, born and raised in the Iranian city of Shiraz, author of Jasmine and Stars and Reading Mystical Lyric, The Case of Jalal ad-Din Rumi. And with me in the studio, and I'm delighted to have him, James Morris, professor of theology at Boston College. He taught himself Persian so that he could study the poetry of Rumi in its original language. He's head of the International Advisory Board of the Rumi Institute in Cyprus, putting on a big conference coming up in December there. Rumi is just hot as can be. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Does all this poetry of mysticism and ecstasy and love clash with your sense of Islam today? And how do images of love, tolerance, silk pillows, cosmopolitanism fit with the contemporary image of Islamic stridency and intolerance? Is this what Westerners want Islam to be, or is it there and just being missed today in the headlines? 800-423-8255 is our number, 800-423-TALK. Warren's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Warren, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you. Yeah. I think it's nice, wonderful that Shams was mentioned. He had quite a, I believe he was a spiritual master, but certainly a great soul and a big And there's some other great poets that probably were in that vein, and I think they speak universally to us, would be Beer, more recently probably Tagore, and of course Hafiz, which wonderful poets. A great line I love of Rumi, if I may, is,
please,
out beyond ideas, wrongdoing and right-doing, there is a fee. I will meet you there.
Oh, goodness, Warren, we're breaking up as if you're calling us from the 13th century a little bit there. We got just enough of that to run with, a kind of reference to Shams, the great mentor, and also to maybe poets in the line of descent, Hafez and Rabindranath Tagore. Fatima, speak to this relationship between Rumi and his spiritual master, if that's the right way to put it. Shams, describe what happened in the meeting of these men.
Yes. Well, as you can imagine, there are lots of stories and no doubt quite a bit of them not exactly factual, you know, woven around the meeting. Shams was a basket weaver and was known as Shams-e-Parande, or the flying Shams, because he hardly ever stayed in one place for too long. A very, very learned man. You know, we know this from his own sermons, if that's the right word to use for his, talking to crowds. And, and he had a very, in some ways, a rough way of communicating that, but a very effective and poetic in his own way. And he said about himself, he said, God wrote three kinds of script. Mm-hmm. One he could read and others as well could read. One kind of script only God could read. And a third kind of script neither God could read nor others, and I'm that kind of script. So
it's like a Zen cone there. You can't figure out what he's
absolutely.
Up to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what is important is that I think when the two met, they both found a great kind of stepped on a mine of gold, if you like, and started benefiting from each other. And Shams says that about Rumi, too, that he's a great mirror for me also to look at myself. And I think that, and as I said earlier, that brought a lot of potential that Rumi had, actualized it. It just made him realize the practical value of living what he had been learning in theory.
Jim Morris, there's a kind of freedom suggested in that line from Shumps. You know, God created three scripts, and I'm the third kind of script that even God cannot read. It suggests a kind of permission to be outside the formal constraints of religion. Do I interpret correctly? And is that still alive today? We don't feel that much.
This goes back to your the Afghan student in Earlham College out there who called in. Somebody who's been all these years teaching about religion, we forget that there are two meanings. There's the meaning of what's the reality, what the Quran calls deen, and the reality of what exists in the being, in the heart. The Quran is all about the divine presence, and everything we experience, everything we are, is the divine presence. Unfortunately, in every religion, in the plurality sense, people lose sight of that. And so it takes people like Shams, like Rumi, and if I may mention here for people who haven't read Rumi, St. Francis, his contemporary, did exactly the same thing in the Christian tradition. Mm-hmm. Brought it back alive, brought it back to the divine love, which is the very essence of the Christian tradition. So you could say that Rumi's poetry is St. Francis of this other tradition. And so it's very important to realize that we live in a time just like Rumi's time. Between the Mongols and the Reconquista and the Crusaders, Islam was about to disappear, it looked like. Mm-hmm. And yet it's through him and others influenced by him and other poets that tradition suddenly spread all over the world after the Mongol invasions. The same thing with St. Francis's time. So in our own time, the truth of religion lives in the hearts of human beings, and Rumi awakens that living truth. Just as other great poets do. So that tension between what the religion human beings create and the religion God creates is a tension that's at the heart of Rumi's poetry. And that's why he appeals to people all over the world.
Coleman Barks, read us more. Recite us more if you'd be good enough. We want to keep this in our ears.
Uh-huh. He says, when you do things from your soul, you feel a river moving in you, a joy. When you do things from your soul, you feel a river moving in you, a joy. And that's what I felt when I first read Arbery's translations in 1976. I felt some new region of loving opening up in front of me. And so that's why I began this work, is because I kept feeling that river moving through.
And it moves. It's powerful in your presentations of Rumi. What do you say to the notion that you've kind of Americanized Rumi? Do you take that as a compliment or something else? Is it deliberate? Are you looking to, you know, sort of bend this man toward the American public in a way that will make him more comprehensible? Or how do you see your role, Coleman?
I'm just trying to make poems in the American free verse tradition that are accessible in the way that Walt Whitman and Galway Connell are accessible to us, and also with Emily Dickinson and Rilke and the others that Fatima mentioned. I claim to be a poet in that tradition of spiritual longing, and so I'm placing him, I'm bringing him forward from the 13th century, into that line, into that lineage. And that's the way I see my role. Mm.
Fatima, do you have another line or two or stanza you might share with us, something that speaks to you or illustrates some angle?
Sure. Actually, Tom, if I might, I would like to just put a quick word in for contemporary Persian poets.
Oh, yes,
because
please.
We have been talking so much about this great tradition in the past. And I was so delighted that Jim pointed out that this is the story of our lives, you know, generation after generation. Mm. And that's very often we forget that that's actually going on right now in Iran.
Right.
We just don't get to hear about it. You earlier on referred to my latest book, Jasmine and Stars, reading more than Lolita in Tehran. Mm-hmm. That's what's in that book, the contemporary Iranian poets, including, for example, a woman like Furoh Farrokhzad, who says, I am naked, 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 like silences in between passionate words. I am naked, and all my wounds have been inflicted by love.
Oh.
You know, this And this woman is a bestseller in Iran today.
Is she a daughter of Rumi? Is she in that lineage?
Absolutely. In a poetic sense, absolutely. And she's also rebelled against Rumi in some ways and renewed her tradition. But I look forward to the times that people like Coleman also translate Farrukh Farrukhzad. I actually tried to steer him in the direction of another poet called Sohrab Sepehri, who's a great contemporary mystic, but I think he is so fascinated by Rumi, he thinks there's a lot more still for him to do.
Well, there's an ocean there, no doubt. Fatima, I wonder if you could recite just a little for us in Persian of Rumi. Is it possible? It'd be wonderful to hear.
Oh, absolutely. Let me just recite a quatrain, which I love.
Can you give us a sense of what it's about before
sure.
you begin?
Sure. It says, love is from pre-eternity. It's going to last till the end of time. The seekers of love are going to be immeasurable in number. Tomorrow, when the day of resurrection comes, only the ones who are not in love will not be able to enter. Hmm. And it reads in Persian, عشق از ازل است تا ابد خواهد بود جوینده عشق بی عدد خواهد بود فردا که قیامت آشکارا گردد آن هر که نه عاشق است رد خواهد بود.
I don't understand a word, and yet I understand everything, and it's absolutely
yes.
beautiful. Thank you for that. We have so many listeners who want to join. Let me turn to Carrie in Newton, Massachusetts. Carrie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And hi, Coleman. I'm a seminary student at a Protestant seminary here in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. and one of the things that happens in seminary that some people may not realize is that you tend to drill down and lose your sense of simple faith. And this happened to me, and it was actually the readings and the study of the Persian mystics that have brought me back and have really spoken to me during this time of great loss that can often be referred to as the dark night of the soul in the Christian tradition. And so I just wanted to say that the thing that I think is so powerful about Rumi and other Persian mystics like Hafiz is that they really do transcend the simpleness of certain religions. They expand your mind and help you think beyond what is concrete into something that is obviously much more mystical and expansive. And for me and many others studying with me in seminary, these poets have really expanded us. And in a time also in our country where religious differences need to be transcended, I think that these Persian mystics really have a role in helping us to find something greater and bigger than the gods of traditional religions.
Carrie, thank you very much for that. Fatima, let me ask you, though, if we were to put this to the mullahs in Iran or to prominent Islamic teachers in the Middle East, would they like to see Rumi as a poet who took believers beyond the constraints of a particular religion, even beyond Islam?
Well, I would say that the category we refer to as the mullahs also have a very wide range of spectrum of views. There are very many clergy who are themselves in love with Rumi and have been great commentators on the writing of Rumi, and those who have opposed him. And I would say those who have loved him are by far outnumber the opposing ones. But I think what they would say is that, and I absolutely agree actually with what the caller said, I would only preface something to it, which is what I would think that the Muslim scholars would tell you, which is he does that transcending of the religion by being deeply rooted in it. He doesn't throw it out of the window. He absorbs it, internalizes it, and then transcends it. So that ability to be able to be so generous and open is that because he's really got very deep in there. And it's just, you know, you can only break the laws you really know very well. And so I would say that there are a great number of Muslim scholars who would love to see the ideas of Rumi to be representing Islam because they themselves read him and translate him and comment on the writing. And there are, of course, always those who would like to see, would be afraid of losing the inner essence of Islam if you really lend it to this kind of freedom and openness. But again, as I said, I Jim can talk about this very authoritatively. I think the number of the Muslim scholars who have loved Rumi and commented on him by far outnumbers the opposing ones.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Coleman Barks, read us one more little bit, if you would, or recite.
A transparent tree grows in the night sky orchard, where I have found a little corner to be in, as when two planets intersect, I have met Shams.
And there it is, Rumi's moment. Coleman Barks, who brought us the essential Rumi, wildly popular, joining us from Athens, Georgia. Thank you for being here, Coleman.
Thank you. It was wonderful to hear Fatima and Jim.
Absolutely.
Thank
you so much. Jim Morris, last word goes to you today. How should we hold this poet in our minds? What of the world should we know through Rumi?
Let me answer with a poem of his.
Please.
Another quatrain. There you see. Oh, friend, through love we are conjoined with you. Wherever you put your foot, we are the ground for you. In this school of loving, how can it possibly be that we see the world through you, and yet we don't see you?
Beautiful again. We need say no more.
It's Rumi in a nutshell.
And we're so grateful for it. It's been such a pleasure to spend this hour with the two of you and with a poet whose birth was 800 years ago this week, Rumi. James Morris, professor of theology at Boston College, wonderful to have you with us today. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And Fatima Keshavarz, joining us from Washington University in St. Louis, author of Jasmine and Stars and reading mystical lyric, The Case of Jalaluddin Rumi. Fatima, thank you very, very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. شبی بر بود ناگه شبی بر بود ناگه شمس تبریز آی ز من یک داد و دای من چه دانم من چه دانم من چه دانم من چه دانم من چه دانم